Most importantly, if anyone's found my Fields keys, I'd like to have them back. Two Fields keys with a white tag. So we've been looking at a problem brought by Luis, Ramon, and Jose from the hospital for sick children, and we've been doing lots of work. This is our group. There are lots and lots of pictures in this. We're heavy on pictures and maybe a little bit light on mathematics. Some of the people thinking, arguing. I think this is us ignoring Lewis, which we did quite a lot. So what the guys from Sick Kids are interested in is detecting functional connectivity in brain activity. And what that means is that so the brain, there's lots of things happening in the brain all the time, and occasionally different parts of the brain begin to behave in sync for a short period of time. And so they want to detect those events. And their tool for doing that is I had to ask how to pronounce this before I started, so I practiced. But magnetoencephalogram. And what this does is it consists of 150 or more sensors around the brain, and all detecting the magnetic field. And so each sensor is producing a time series of magnetic field data. And the idea is to look at these time series and see if we can detect things in those time series that indicate that inside the brain there were distinct regions that were having these contemporary synchronized events. That's a picture of an EEG, not an MEG. MEGs are much bigger and more expensive. Here's a fairly unhappy looking person in an MEG. So this is the kind of data that we get from the MEG. So on the top graph are two time series, superimposed. So there's a green one superimposed and a blue one. And this event here is actually a seizure that the person had during the experiment. And on here, what we plotted is synchrony between these two signals. I'm going to talk about what synchrony means in the next couple of slides. And you can see that that sort of during normal behavior, the synchrony is kind of going all over the place. And then during the seizure, we get very high synchrony between these two sensors. And that's because during a seizure, your whole brain there's kind of massive signals kind of happening all over the brain. So this isn't the kind of thing that we want to detect. We're not interested in seizures where kind of at every sensor you're seeing everything kind of going wild in the same kind of way. What we're interested in is kind of smaller synchronized events that occur kind of during normal functioning of the brain. This final chart here shows the phase difference between these signals, which I'll mention in a few slides what that means. These were shown at the beginning of the week. But the idea here is that we're picking one sensor on one point on the brain, and then what the plot shows is how synchronized that sensor is with all of the other sensors that are around. So if you wanted to have a picture of everything that was happening at this particular point in time, what you would do is you would produce, so there's 150 sensors, you produce 150 of these pictures, and that would tell you what's going on. And you can see, so during a seizure, you get kind of very strongly synchronized sort of regions of the brain. This is normal brain activity, and you get much lower synchronization. But you see there's a little patch down here which is a bit more synchronized with this guy over here. Is that fluke or is that really these two bits, you know, the bit of the brain near this sensor and the bit of the brain near this sensor actually acting in a synchronized way. And these pictures show one of the problems with the idea of using synchrony, which is that, so in the region of the, so if you look at the sensors close to, so you pick a sensor, and then you look at the sensors nearby, well, they tend to be synchronized with that first sensor. And that's because both those, that could be because, it's most likely because both those sensors are picking up signals coming from the same bit of the brain, the bit of the brain kind of in between them. So there's, I guess, kind of one of the big questions is so at what point can you ask, can you say, look, hang on, this isn't coming from just the fact that these two sensors are seeing the same bit of the brain, but they're actually seeing two different bits of the brain which are having one of these synchronized events. So this is the physics that describes what's going on. So this the Biot-Savart law tells us the Biot-Savart law tells us the magnetic field due to a magnetic dipole. So we measure it, so that we model the brain as a collection of magnetic dipoles which have a fixed moment, a fixed direction, but then the field is varying. That's the point. So if we pick one of those and we want to see what the field is, this tells us how to calculate it, and we're then going to be measuring the normal component of that field in one of these sensors around the brain. And you can see it's a 1 over r cubed relation. So most sensors are going to be, so, and the sensors get to be pretty close to the head, so you're going to be seeing much stronger signals from things which are close to the sensor than things which are further away. So in principle, we could take all of our data and we could assume that there are n dipoles in the brain with different positions and different directions and a time series, and we could solve an inverse problem, and we could get a model for what was happening in the brain, and then we could look at that, we could look at the results of that inverse problem directly and examine bits and pieces for and examine each of these dipoles and see if they're having these synchronized events. That's totally infeasible. We only have 150 sensors. There are millions of these things in the brain. It's also quite a difficult problem. We don't know how many of them there are, but there's also non-linearity when you start to allow them to move around. And we don't have it up here, but there's an additional problem, which is that it's not clear that your synchrony measure, so the synchrony measure which I'm going to come to in a couple of slides is a non-linear measure. So if you made a kind of a linear assumption, if you simplified your model of the brain down to a fixed number of dipoles, then is it really appropriate to model this large number of dipoles by kind of assuming that they all behave like one guy and then looking for the synchronization of it. So that's why approach isn't to kind of try and solve the inverse problem for this. But so let's look at how we detect synchronicity. So given two time series, so these are real value time series, the idea is to compute a phase for these time series. And the way that that's done is to use the Hilbert transform to extend these time series to be complex valued, and once they're complex valued, we can then measure a phase. So rather than we started with a time series that was doing this, it's now going to be spinning around in a complex plane. So we can ask for its phase, and then if we're going to compare two time series, what we do is we take the difference between their phases, and if we integrate e to the I times that difference, well, if that difference is constant, then when we integrate this, when we take a time average of e to the I times that difference, then we'll get something, we'll get one if it's constant. If it's varying, then eventually as we integrate round e to the I times this thing sparing, then we'll get zero. So one of the questions that we asked is, well, how is that different from correlation? I mean, another obvious thing to do would just be to measure the correlation between two signals. What does synchronicity pick up that correlation doesn't pick up? So here's a few little numerical experiments where measuring the synchrony and the correlation between two different signals. So here's an indication of what synchrony does and of how they're different. So if you take two sine functions, they're both perfectly synchronized. Synchrony is 1 and correlation is 1. I'll read out these numbers because I bet you can't see them at the back. But if you take a sine and a cosine function, these are still perfectly synchronized because they still have a constant phase difference, but they have zero correlation. And if you take something that's sort of, if you take a sine function and then something whose phase is a bit in between, it's still perfectly synchronized, but the correlation is the correlation is 0.71. Final chart shows what happens when the two things that you're measuring have different frequency. If you took a long enough time window, then both the synchrony and the correlation would be zero for things that have a different frequency. And here's a couple of examples. Well, we saw something in the last slide where the synchrony was when the correlation was zero. Here's another one with the synchrony 1, the correlation low. Here's an interesting example where these two signals have very low synchrony, so synchrony is 0.07, but the correlation is quite high, it's 0.82. So these really are two quite different measurements. You kind of expect to see that, you might expect to see that synchrony of 1 roughly correlates with correlation of 1 or -1. And so when we did an experiment to pick 6,000 random pairs of signals, these are all combinations of sine functions with the frequencies chosen between 0 and 6. So very roughly speaking, these are sort of clustered around the line from 0,0 up to 1,1 and 0,0 up to -1,1. But there's also, you know, it's clear that these two things aren't the same measure. Here, the samples taken from slightly different spaces, the second frequency is taken from a space with, on average, twice the frequency of the first, the same kind of pattern. Okay, that's sort of the extent of our investigation onto kind of looking for alternative measures of synchrony. But staying with the synchrony measurement that they use, one of the things that concerned us is that before they apply this synchrony measure, they take their time series and they apply a very narrow frequency filter to those signals. So the frequency filter will be kind of in transition. You said you weren't going to put those in. So if they're looking around 30 hertz, they'll put a four hertz width filter on there. So it seems kind of intuitively, if you start to put a narrow frequency filter on your data before you measure the synchrony between two things, that's going to change your synchrony rating. I mean, clearly in the limit, as you know, if we put a delta function filter on there, we're going to get two things which are perfectly synchronized because we're going to get two sines or cosines which are the same frequency. And that's what they see in the data. So they see a baseline level at which, if you just put white noise into the frequency calculation, white noise should give you zero synchrony. But in fact, after you filter it with the 4 hertz filter, you get 0.03. So we spent a bit of time working out exactly why that is the case, but also why you need to filter, and then we also spent some time trying to calculate this number. Now we didn't calculate that number, but we do have some insight into why you need to filter and why filter increases synchronization. These are the best pictures of the talk, I think. So what this diagram is showing is that suppose you have a periodic function. We can write its Fourier series, and if the function is periodic, these Cn decay. Now, what happens when you complexify this is you take the what do you get? So the first term in your Fourier series results in this contribution to the complexified value. The next term is this contribution. The next term is this contribution, and because these CNs are decaying, things get smaller and smaller. The phase that we're measuring for each of these signals is this measurement here. So if these guys are getting smaller and smaller, and we just chop off at a certain frequency level, then we're not changing the phase by all that much. So that justifies using a high frequency filter when we know we have periodic data. What happens when you have white noise, we've got all the C's, the contributions, are all the same length. So we keep adding these guys up, and our eventual phase looks like this. And it's pretty clear that if you don't do any filtering, you're going to get totally wild behavior for this phase. So what's happening is so this angle into here is proportional to t, and so is this angle, and so is this angle, and so is this angle, and so is this angle. So if t increases, this guy's just going to go wild. It's going to go all over the place. So if we're looking at a signal that's got a combination of something that we're interested in, something periodic that we're interested in, but also something that's basically white noise, the white noise is going to totally dominate the phase calculation and is going to screw everything up. So that's the motivation for why there's a need to filter. But we don't. This doesn't mean necessarily that a straightforward frequency-based filter is the right thing to do. So one of the things we looked at was rather than kind of arbitrarily choosing this frequency window, to making it the point that it's going to produce some data that we can work with, try a different way of filtering the data. So what the idea that I've forgotten the name of the guy that looked at it. David looked at was to do a principal components analysis of the data. And so the idea here is that we've got a time series, so for each of our sensors we have a time series that gives us we've got n values, so that's n points in time. So we can consider each time series to be a point in n-dimensional space. And then what the principal components analysis does, if I understand it correctly, is you search for a subspace which captures the you pick a dimension, something smaller than n, and we now look for a hyperplane onto which we can project the data that will capture as much as possible of the variation that we had in the original data. So here we're just looking at two time points, and what the analysis would do is it would identify that this direction here, this is a plane which captures most of the variation, and then so the second thing is just going to be orthogonal to that. So if we took the principal component, that would be giving us kind of this amount of the variation. So this is a numerical experiment based on some real data, and you can see how this is the first component, the second component, the third component, and then these are the end components. The early components look kind of smooth, and they appear to have structure in them. The end components look like noise. So maybe if you throw away these guys and keep these guys, you'll get something that doesn't have the noise that's going to pollute the phase calculation, but still has the important kind of correlated behavior, synchronized behavior, that will give you a synchrony measure. This is So this is this example here. I think that blue is the original signal. Here's what happens when you keep the first seven components, and this is half of it is the frequency spectrum, and it seems to have preserved kind of important things of the frequency spectrum. We didn't go on and do the calculation to see what we didn't do any experiments to see how that then affects the what effect that does have on synchrony, but that's an obvious thing to go and look at. So going back to actually kind of solving the problem kind of in the brain, more good pictures. We know that the inverse problem for the whole brain is not possible to go that route. So what we thought about was, can we pose an inverse problem that, you know, can we pose this as an approximation problem that at least we have some kind of hope of solving? And so the idea for this suppose that we start off with just random dipoles all over the brain. This is a two-dimensional brain, and so our sensors live around the outside, and the position of our sensors is parameterized by theta. Then, if we measured the synchrony between one sensor and another sensor, then we'd see a strong amount of synchrony along the diagonal here, because things which are nearby are synchronized with other things which are nearby. We call this autosynchrony, and this is just the thing which I showed at the beginning with the experiments on real data, that this sensor is synchronized with things which are nearby. So the idea is to say, well, okay, so start with a random field, and now compare that to let's compare that to something that you see. So maybe when you go measure this, so we can now look at because I've just got this kind of one-dimensional parameterization of sensors, I can look at all of the sensors at the same time. I know I'm going to see this thing down the diagonal. Maybe I'm going to see some patches, so always going to be symmetric. That some patches are synchrony. So we could ask, well, what's a better model for this? If we allow ourselves one pair of synchronized dipoles, can we fit this picture better than if we have no synchronized dipoles in there? So then you have an optimization problem, which is just over. So we take this, we allow ourselves one pair, we now optimize over all the possible positions of the dipoles. Well, so in the real brain, that's, you've got six parameters for each dipole, so you're optimizing over 12 parameters. Maybe there's more if you choose what signal you're going to put at those dipoles, but that's a much more tractable kind of problem. And then clearly, kind of, as you throw in more dipoles, you're always going to get a better fit as you have more dipoles to the problem. So you then use a statistical test to trade off between the fact that you're adding in degrees of freedom and you're getting a better fit. And there are ways to penalize the degrees of freedom, so that you can decide, well, okay, now I'm going to stop adding in correlated dipoles because I'm cheating. I'm just adding in lots and lots of things. Okay, what's this? Ah, yeah. Okay, so clearly, if we wanted to implement this, and we weren't able to implement this during the week, we would need a forward solver to be able to take our two arbitrarily placed dipoles and calculate this. So we had I think some progress towards implementing a forward solver for this. So this is with three dipoles placed arbitrarily in the brain, somewhere fairly close to the surface. This was the signal at a particular sensor. This was the synchrony. The calculation's wrong, but it got better like towards the end of yesterday. So anyway, we're on our way to having a simple kind of forward solver. So the final thing that we looked at was it's really related to the last problem, is how good a resolution can we get? And for this we took the very toy problem, where we have if you have two sensors and I give you a reading at those two sensors, I think it's pretty obvious that you could always find a dipole. You can find lots of different solutions to this, but you can always find a dipole that will give you the two readings that you're reading at those two points. You can always put something around it that will do that. So the question we asked was, okay, so suppose I have three sensors. Is it possible, for every value at these three sensors, is it possible that can always be created by one dipole? And the point of asking that question is that if you can identify values for which it's not possible that what you're seeing is created by one dipole, that tells you you've got two dipoles. And if you then extend that further, we were looking very much just at the case of just the signal, not only certainly synchrony, but that then could tell you that you're seeing synchrony, that there must be two dipoles acting together in order to create this signal. So it's not a totally stupid problem, because we're only modeling So we might expect to be able to do it, because we've got three numbers here. We're just measuring the normal components, and we have what do we have to play with? Well, we have two numbers for the position of the dipole, and we have 2 degrees of freedom for the magnitude and direction of the dipole. So we've got 4 degrees of freedom, and we're trying to match three things. So we might be able to do this at three sensors with just one dipole. So reminder again, this is the formula for the field strength at a sensor from a dipole. And we just make some simplifying assumptions. So let's put all of this in two dimensions. And so if we say that if you've got a dipole at x, so x minus d, and we're measuring at a sensor at 0, 0, this is the sensor that you read, this is the signal that you read at the sensor. And just to illustrate what's happening there, so these three graphs show you, so this is for the dipole, so this is the this is what you measure. So if you place a dipole directly under a sensor and then just vary the angle of the dipole, this is this is a function of x. Okay, so you place a dipole at x equals 0, and we vary the. I might be wrong here. Am I varying the dipole, or am I varying the sensor? The sensor. Okay. So I place a dipole at position so 0 minus d, and I measure along here, and this is what I see for different angles of the dipole. So the that was yeah, I think so, yeah. Well, I mean, it's going to scale up, but yeah. So we can pose this problem. We can say, so let's put without loss of generality, we can say that we measure one at the middle sensor, and then we've got F1 at the left hand sensor and F2 at the right hand sensor. And so what we're trying to do then is we're trying to solve. So we get three equations that we're trying to solve. So we can eliminate Q and theta, and we end up. And this is what we're looking for. So if we fix, the question is: are there values? The question is: are there values of d and x that are consistent with any observed f1 and f2? So if we just fix d equals 1, which is reasonably realistic, actually, that's the sensor spacing is kind of proportional to the distance between the sensors, the distance into the brain between where the sensors are and the nearby, which is the same order of magnitude as the distance from the sensors to the nearby dipoles. Then we can show that this solution the solution is either going to have two or no roots for x, depending on the values of f1 and f2. And you can plot the separatrix between those two regions, and then just do a couple of experiments to determine what each region means. And so this, what this is telling you is that if I pick a value of S1 and S2 in here, then there are two solutions for the, there are two possible dipoles that could have created that. If I pick a value of S1 and S2 out in here, there's nothing that could have created it. So a bit of intuition to this. Well, so what this is saying, so if I looked at 3, 3, this is saying if I'm measuring 3, 1, and 3, then I can't reproduce that with one dipole, which kind of makes sense because as you kind of made this thing stronger here, one, you've got this guy in the middle, it's going to be very low, and then something strong over there. And here's an example of the two solutions. So if you chose -3, so over here, and then one in the middle, and then two, the diagram says that you can find two solutions for that, and these are the two solutions. One of them is quite a nearby dipole, and the other one is this crazy guy over here. That's the sensible part of this discussion. The next two slides are the unsensible part. So that, remember, I fixed D equals 1 here. So I said I'm only going to look for dipoles at distance 1 coming down from where the sensors are. What if I allow D today? Can I move into this space? Well, if you allow D to vary, you get craziness. So these are still separatrixes, but what they're separating, I don't think we know for definite. But you've got all kinds of cusps appearing, and whether it means anything, I don't know. Peter seems confident that no, Peter's not confident it means anything at all. So here's his superimposed lots of those graphs for lots of D's. All above some critical value around 0.345. This is kind of interesting because this is telling you that if we're having D kind of above this level, so if we're saying that we can only be looking for dipoles that are above a level fairly close to where the sensors were, then if you see something in this regime or in this regime, you know that was created by two dipoles. If you allow D to decrease below 0.345, you get just craziness. There's lines going everywhere, and that probably means you can produce whatever you want if you allow yourself to get close to the sensors. Anyway, that's it.
Okay, thanks, Joel. We have time for a couple questions.
Sure. That modeling that you did earlier on, do you think it might be better to exclude some of the dipoles in the center because the one on R cubed will have damped them out quite a lot?
Yeah.
I think it was a nice simulation, but I think including the dipoles in the center could give a bias to the results.
But
I'm wondering what you felt.
Yeah. So all I was really doing there was just trying to vaguely pose this problem, and I think in practice you wouldn't put things in the center. You keep them all on the outside because the ones in the center, I mean, if they're going to create any kind of synchrony, it's going to be seizure type. I mean, for them to have an effect, you've got to have a massive signal from the center. So I think you're right that if you wanted to pose this, that you probably place all your, if you were going to set this up, you probably place your dipoles around the edge. To your base field of dipoles on the edge.
So anyone else? Okay, if I can have a few words from Luis for the day.
Yes, just only one thing. We didn't tell you on Monday during the presentation that this problem has been occupying the minds of scientists for about 2 decades of many of them, and so far there's been no solution. So obviously we didn't want to tell you this, otherwise I don't think none of you would have been interested. And in general, I think we're limited by the methodologies that we have. So it's all, unlike in science, it's all an approximation to reality. So hopefully something will come out of this. Thank you very much.
So our last talk in the second session will be from NXP Semiconductor.